Bob Knight coached three Indiana University teams to three NCAA championship titles. He's the second winningest coach in NCAA history with 902 victories and a record he's equally proud of. Almost all of his players graduated. He left Indiana after controversy, went on to coach at Texas Tech, and he's now retired from coaching and a featured commentator for ESPN's college basketball coverage. In a new book, he shows how his principles of coaching might apply to other aspects of life. It's called The Power of Negative Thinking. It's published by New Harvest, and I'm very pleased that it brings Coach Knight back to our show today. Hello.
Nice to see you.
Now, you cite political history to make a point about winning and losing on the basketball court. The 1948 presidential election, well, we all know that Truman was supposed to lose, and the Chicago Tribune had that famous headline, and he went on to defeat Dewey.
You know,
how does that apply to basketball?
Well, I had a copy of that headline on my desk. And, you know, it simply was a matter of Truman greatly outworking Dewey. And the fact that Dewey was content with where he was, assured that he was going to win. And to me, that just shows me that Truman did a heck of a lot more to win the game than Dewey did. And I think that falls into everything. It can be basketball, broadcasting, whatever. Complacency is always going to lose, particularly when complacency is confronted by somebody energetic and somebody really working to prove a point.
So when we see a team that is just composed of a lot of great players and they still lose to a team that has fewer great players, that's because they were complacent?
Well, I don't know whether they're complacent or not. They weren't as well prepared. They weren't as sharp. They probably didn't practice as hard. When a team with superior talent gets beat, it's because of two things. The team with superior talent hasn't worked hard enough or prepared well enough, and the team with lesser talent is probably much better prepared than the team with greater talent.
Now, you address a number of sports cliches in this book, like look on the bright side, there's no shame in defeat, the other team wanted it more. In the end, everything works out for the best. Time heals all wounds. Does it annoy you to hear them?
Well, it doesn't really annoy me, but I think that's all BS. I think there isn't anything there that helps you. You know, when you start talking about how you like things will be better tomorrow. Well, why are they going to be better tomorrow? You know, I think they're words.
Well, the Dodgers fans used to say, wait till next year.
Well, there are words in sports or in any endeavor that I think are really important. And the most important word is no, because you never really get in much of a bind if you say no. And when you do say no, it gives you a chance to think things over a little bit. And then maybe you should say yes, but you wait a while and you give yourself that chance by, first of all, saying no. And then another really important word, I think, is you ask me to do something. And I may be willing to do it, but I'm not really sure what it is. If I say, why should I help you? And now I get a better idea. Or why do you want me to do this? And now I have, and maybe it's something I thought, well, I don't want to do. But once I know why, it may be something that I want to do.
So that applied to you're talking with one of your players. If you just said to him, you know, do this, it wasn't as effective as telling him why you wanted him.
You know, that's a very good point and a very good approach to what I tried to do. Let's say that we had a kid we're on defense, let's say, and we give up a basket because one of our players, let's call him Jimmy, one of our players didn't cover his position defensively well enough. And so now I've got to say, Jimmy, you've got to help. You've got to help. And if he nods his head and then helps the next time, I've gotten through to him. If I haven't, I probably need to put Jimmy on the bench and put Joey in there who's going to do what I want. I think that you really, in anything that you do, when you're the person in charge, and I tried never to forget that I was in charge, you've got to make sure that your people understand. It's as important and incumbent upon you to understand what you need to do to help as it is for them to do it.
So did you actually sit down with the team and explain your philosophy of the game, the equivalent of a mission statement in a regular business?
Oh, yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. When we prepared for a game, it was my starting points were always these. Okay, boys, here's what we've got to do on defense against this team.
And it may Which be is a different little, than the last team.
Exactly right. It may be a little bit different than the last team. Or here's what we have to do offensively in this game. They're going to play a zone. We're going to work on our zone offense. And I even went so far as to do this. I would sometimes, when a game was well in hand, with a few minutes to go, I might have our starting players on the bench telling them about the next game. And I simply called it last game, next game. And so many people, players, coaches, politicians, whatever, they're not able to get to the next game quick enough. And in doing so, their failure to get to the next game causes them to lose everything they're doing.
Well, you're now a commentator, and often commentators during games, football, basketball, hockey, will say, they've abandoned their game plan, and that's why they've suddenly are not doing as well. I have always wondered, why would anybody abandon a game plan?
It probably just isn't working as well as they thought it was. And to me, then, you've got to adjust a little bit. Maybe let's look at it this way. Their game plan was to pick up the other team at midcourt. Well, all of a sudden, they found that the other team was quicker than they thought they were. So now you drop
adjusted.
Exactly. So now you drop your defense back. You'd be a good coach. You understand this pretty well. And the word adjustment is very, very important. When you're getting beat, don't be afraid to adjust. In fact, try to find the adjustment that's going to get you into a position where you can win.
My guest is Bob Knight, who's written with the help of Bob Hamill, The Power of Negative Thinking, an Unconventional Approach to Achieving Positive Results. It's published by New Harvest. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The title of your book is obviously a reference to the famous bestseller by Norman Vincent Peale, The Power of Positive Thinking. He was a clergyman, and you talk about being bothered when a player makes the sign of a cross before every free throw, or when a baseball player who's just hitting a home run points to the sky after he's hit home plate.
Well, you know, I think we as a people depend too much on things that maybe just aren't there. Like, how else could you think about this? Guy hits a home run, and he crosses home plate, and he points heavenwardly as though a heavenly body aided him in hitting this home run. Now, I see this, and I say to myself, God screwed the pitcher. So how else can you look at it?
And if the pitcher was just as religious or more religious than the batter, then what are we saying? God's picking favorites?
I would think that if we're going to use the thank you to begin with, yeah, I would think so.
You write that you're comfortable being a contrarian. When did you develop your theory of the power of negative thinking?
Well, you know, when I was just a youngster, my grandmother lived with us, and I can remember asking her, Grandma, I'd like to go to the movie, or Grandma, I'd like to go out to the park swimming. And she would look at me if that wasn't going to happen, and she would say, you just keep this in mind. You wish you could do things. You hope you can do things. Well, here's the truth. If wishes were horses, beggars would ride. That was my grandmother's favorite saying. And I think that's the first negative thing to bring about something positive. In other words, she's telling me, you know, get out and work a little bit and you'll be able to do things that you want to do. You'll be able to make a little money to go to the movie or go swimming, whatever it might be.
So you're saying wishing, hoping is one thing, but doing the hard work is what's really necessary.
Well, you know, we always talk about the will to win, and that fits right in with what you're talking about. We basically all have a will to win, but we don't all have the will to prepare to win. And so we want to win, we hope we win, but we better have prepared extremely well if we're going to win. And we always talk about that will to win. I think the will to prepare to win is infinitely more important than the will to win.
You say Duke didn't beat Butler in the NCAA championship game because Duke's players wanted victory a little more. You say Duke that night just did a little bit more.
Played a little bit better over the course of the game. They made a few more better plays, and that difference resulted in Duke's championship.
And they made fewer mistakes.
Yes.
Now, is that because the players were smarter or because their coach wasn't telling them the right stuff?
You know, it
would be... Because good coaches do lose games.
Well, there's no question. But you know, the difference there, if I remember correctly, is either 1 or 2 points. So that's a minimal difference at best. So you can't see... Either one of two teams had a chance to win the game. You don't say that Duke won the game because they did more or they did less. Duke won the game because they performed at the moment they had to perform. It was an isolated situation where they performed. Had they missed the shot, then Butler would have probably won the game. So we take one incident here.
And I've always wondered why I've seen this all too often. The game is very close, and there are just a couple of seconds left, or maybe there's a more than a couple of seconds left, and somebody takes a stupid shot when there was an opportunity to take a smarter shot. The shot misses, the game is over.
Well,
you know, is it just because the adrenaline is so overwhelming?
That... Well, to an extent, I think so, but I always wanted you to take the shot. You know, we want to get...
You didn't know how bad I was
well,
as a basketball
player. I'm figuring that you were good, okay? We're going to give you an entree into being a really good player here for a second. So we all know that you're our first choice. We won the NCAA tournament 1 year beating Syracuse in the championship game. One of our players, Keith Smart, made a basket at the buzzer, probably the most famous basket in the history of NCAA tournament play. Our leading scorer, our best shooter, was Steve Alford. Now, what Steve did to contribute to this was he just worked his tail off trying to get a shot. And Syracuse really concentrated on not giving him the shot. So, in what Syracuse was trying to do, they were successful. They did a very good job in not letting Steve get open. However, we were fortunate in that Steve Smart, Keith did not just stand around. Keith worked to get open, and then he hit the shot. So it wasn't anything that Syracuse didn't do, or it really wasn't anything that we did do, with the exception that we had a kid under the bucket named Daryl Thomas, who made the play of the game when, instead of taking it up against two bigger players, found Smart open and made the pass. And I've always said that Daryl's recognition of not being able to score at that point and the pass was far more important than the shot that Keith took.
Well, one of the rules should be find the open man.
Oh, absolutely.
But you have 10 commandments of negative thinking in this book, things like don't accept the status quo, always question, always worry.
Worry, think about this. Worry has won a lot more games than confidence has. Worry means that you're thinking about it, you're working harder, you're not saying, we're okay, this is not a very good team. Worry has won a lot more games than overconfidence has.
But boxers will tell you that if they don't go into the ring with a positive attitude, if they think, wow, this guy's really good, I might find myself whipped tonight, that they're almost guaranteed to lose. They have to have a positive attitude. What's wrong with a positive attitude?
I don't think there's anything wrong with a positive attitude, but thinking, hoping, wishing everything is going to turn out okay just doesn't get the job done. You have to have faith in yourself, but you have to do those things that allow you to win. And from different sports are different things, but I've always felt that when I'm preparing for a game, I want to first of all know what can they do to beat us. then what can we do to beat them? I want to know how they can beat us. And then we've got to eliminate that. But I don't want to go into a game saying, well, we've got better players than they have, or we're better prepared than, or we're playing at home. There are all kinds of false things that are positive that we give ourselves rather than, okay, what is it that we need to do that we haven't done to win this game?
So it's a matter of playing to win rather than playing not to lose.
Yeah, you play not to lose, you're going to lose a lot. You know, you're trying to win. The object of the game is to win. And I tried to do everything I can in my way. I've just always been a guy that doesn't believe in the tooth fairy. I've never believed in the tooth fairy. And there are so many other things.
But what happened when you found that money under the pillow anyway after you lost your tooth?
Well, I probably,
you were still happy, weren't you?
I probably figured that I was young enough that my mother put a dollar there.
Bob Knight has written, with the help of Bob Hamill, The Power of Negative Thinking, An Unconventional Approach to Achieving Positive Results. It's published by New Harvest, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Bob Knight, who is now a featured commentator for ESPN's college basketball coverage, but is the second winningest coach in the history of the NCAA with 902 victories. He's written a book called The Power of Negative Thinking, An Unconventional Approach to Achieving Positive Results, written with the help of Bob Hamill, and published by New Harvest. You, in the early 1960s, you played on the great Ohio State teams with Jerry Lucas and John Havlicek under coach Fred Taylor. That must have been an amazing experience. What did you learn from those teams that you carried with you into coaching?
Well, you know, we had a coach in Coach Taylor. We had an assistant coach in Frank Truitt, and another assistant coach in Jack Graff. And they were all three demanding. They wanted the best out of every player. I started a few games here and there, but mostly came in off the bench. So I knew what I was supposed to do, and we had great players. You mentioned two of them in Havlicek and Lucas. Siegfried was another one, and Joe Roberts was another one, and Dick Furry. It was a great team. And I really enjoyed being a part of it because when I started coaching, I looked back over that team about how hard players worked and how well they worked together. And I tried to take every coach that I had ever played for, from Little League baseball right on through college basketball, and I wrote down those things that I liked and those things that I didn't like. And that's kind of how I started coaching.
Well, is that how you learn coaching? Didn't you major in history at Ohio State? Are there coaching majors?
No. I think then you would probably were most likely to get a major in physical education. But I was a real history buff. I like to read about history, like to study it. My major was history and government. And when I graduated, I actually was certified to teach 9 different subjects in the state of Ohio.
And then you wound up spending the first part of your coaching career at West Point. So did military history also influence you in the way you approach coaching?
I had a chance the year that I, again, going back to the power of negative thinking, I had a chance. I was the only player on that team as a senior who was graduating with an interest in coaching basketball. So I had some opportunities around the state of Ohio to be a head coach at some smaller schools. And as I was trying to make up my mind, I said to myself a very negative thing that I think was incredibly important to my future. I said, you know, I really don't know how to coach. I know how to play, but I don't know how to coach. And what I did when I said that to myself, I took a job with a man at Cahoga Falls High School, a suburb of Akron, named Harold Andreas. And Andy was one of the 5 best coaches I've ever known in my life. And by my saying to myself, I don't know how to coach, it really helped me learn how to coach by working with Andy for a year. It was a great, great move for me.
Well, did you develop one philosophy of coaching, or did it have to change? Because there are 2 different kinds of coaches, as far as I can tell. One is somebody who has a style and then has the players play within that style, no matter who the players are. And the other one who says, well, these guys are so totally different from my last team, I have to change my approach to the game to fit them.
I think you always have to fit your talent. But I think you can do that in the broad scope of things. Like, let's say, okay, my most important thought was playing defense. The less they can score, the better chance we have to win. Now, we may pick our defense up at midcourt. And what you're saying, very good point. Next year, we've lost three of our quickest players. Now what we have to do is not say to ourselves, and this is where I think the power of negative thinking, we're not as quick as we were last year. We can't go out as far as we did last year. So now we have to move our defense back to the top of the key. And so rather than sticking with something that was really good for us in the past, now it was a very good point you make. Now,
well, there are those run-and-gun coaches, even if they have teams that are a little slower and maybe have other skills.
Well, some coaches stick with the pattern, regardless of what kind of talent they have. And they are basically coaches that don't win a lot.
You bolster your case for negative thinking leading to positive results with many examples of leaders throughout history who use such tactics. I'm talking about non-sports people like the Chinese general Sun Tzu, Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, I think Abraham Lincoln was great. You talk about some of Lincoln's addresses, some of his leadership. I think Lincoln was a person that really had a lot of negative thinking because of his involvement with the Civil War, trying to get away from that and trying to do what was right for so many people. I think George Washington, another one. Washington, right here on Long Island, said in essence, hey, we're going to get our butts whipped right here. We got to get out of here. And they moved up north and crossed the Hudson and then won the Battle of Trenton. Had Washington said, we're going to stay right here and fight, we might all be speaking with a British accent today.
You write, my feeling is that today, way too often, hope has replaced sweat. A week ago in the New York Times Magazine, you even were quoted saying the worst word in the English language is hope.
Well, I really believe, what's hope going to do, you know? Come here, Susie, let Mommy kiss that scratch on your knee. Well, Mommy better have iodine on her tongue because that kiss ain't going to help any.
But there are players who thrive on positive reinforcement, aren't there?
Well, I think that you can't get a kid to do what he can't do. You know, every kid that I ever coached, I said, now here is what you are as a player. And this is how you've got to play. And we aren't all going to take the same number of shots. You know, you, in fact, I don't want to shoot. The only shots you're going to take are going to be drives to the bucket. But you are going to be our most important defensive player. So I've given you something right there that is an indication I think you can be a tremendous asset to us in winning.
People often complain that the game has gotten away from the coaches, that players come in with their own attitudes. Some of them just want to do the spectacular play no matter what, and it's impossible to get through to them.
Well, those players didn't last long with me, nor did I try to recruit
them.
Well,
in the pro game, of course, if they have big contracts, they're going to wind up...
That's a different battle, and that's one reason why. You have made great points there. I never had any interest whatsoever in coaching professional basketball.
Because of that?
Because of that. I went to a couple of things early in my coaching career where I was asked to speak to different groups, one NBA, another NFL. And in speaking to those two groups, I just was not interested in coming back from either one that I wanted to coach people reacting as they did the things that were being said.
In addition to the three NCAA championships and 11 Big Ten titles during your 29 seasons at Indiana, you also graduated 76% of your players?
About 96%.
Oh, wow. You know, Dean Smith was here some years ago, and he talked about that being one of his proudest achievements as well. He said even if they left before their senior year, he had them sign a little paper that said, I'm going to come back and get my degree.
That's how Dean looked at it, and that's exactly how I looked at it. Isaiah Thomas, as an example, helped us considerably win a national championship as a sophomore, left to go to the NBA, and eventually got his degree. If I were recruiting your son, what I would tell you and your wife is this. The one thing I can guarantee you is that your son will stay and graduate. And I thought that was my most important obligation as a coach to parents, was to see that the son, not that he won the championship or that he was a drafted by the pros, but that he had a degree to rely on when he got away from college.
Doesn't that also guarantee that you have smarter players? Because there are some kids that go into college with very, you know, with limited learning skills, but they have great basketball
skills.
There's
no question, but some of those kids work very hard to be good students, and they graduate. So I think that if we were able to take kids that weren't maybe at that point prepared to do as well academically as other kids, then we could help them do so. And it was a big point of mine, class attendance. If you didn't go to class, you ran the steps. And we only ever had to run anybody one time. That was huge for me, and the players knew that. They knew how important it was to me that they graduated. And then when they did, they realized how important it had been to them.
Floyd Little was on our show not long ago, one of the greatest running backs in the history of football. And when he was in high school, he tested low on his IQs, I think something where in the 80s or so. He's obviously a very smart man. He got the right kind of positive reinforcement, and he improved his IQ scores. And now, of course, he's one of the people who runs the Denver Broncos.
Well, he obviously was willing to do what was necessary to become a better student than he was. One of my all-time favorite people is a Syracuse graduate, Jimmy Brown. Mm-hmm. And nothing pleased me more than one time Jimmy Brown was quoted as saying, if he had a son that was a basketball player, he would want him to play for me. And that's among the nicest things, the neatest things that ever occurred for me.
Now, a number of players you coached went on to coach in college and the pros, most notably one of the most famous these days, Coach Mike Krzyzewski at Duke, Steve Alford at New Mexico, Mike Woodson of our New York Knicks, your son, Pat, at Lamar. What qualities do they share that they learned from you?
Well, I think that they had to learn about work. They had to learn about looking at each opponent differently. I think if you were to talk to them, they would tell you that they paid attention. Most of those guys still call me, talk to me about this or that as far as the game is concerned. I never really tried to encourage anybody to go into coaching. If those kids that played for me that ended up wanting to coach, then I tried to do what I could to help them do
that. Could you spot the ones who would be more likely to go into coaching?
Well, let's take Krzyzewski as an example. He was not a very good shooter. And in fact, as a sophomore, I remember telling Mike that when the season started, I said, Mike, your responsibilities are not going to entail scoring. We've got enough scoring. But here's how you're going to help this team. Defensively, you're going to play the best guard on the other team always. We cannot get Jimmy Oxley in foul trouble, a really good guard offensively, and also a good defensive guard, really good player, one of the best ever at Army. So that's your responsibility, number one. Your second responsibility is to handle the ball so you get it to people that can score. Now, years later, I think realizing what his abilities were and how he could best contribute is a thing that has helped Mike become an excellent coach, because he understood himself. So now he's been able to understand his players much better than a lot of guys who have tried to coach but never understood themselves.
One other achievement during your time in Bloomington is the fact that you ran a clean program with no NCAA violations. Is that difficult these days, because there are always those guys who are hanging around offering players money?
I think it's a huge problem. I think summer basketball, basically because of the people that run the teams and the tournaments, is a real sore on college basketball. I think there's so many things go on with summer basketball. The high school coaches have been virtually eliminated from the recruiting process. There's just a lot that the NCAA, an organization that I'm not particularly pleased with from almost the beginning, with the exception of at one point Walter Byers was the chairman of the NCAA committee and maybe the smartest man ever in college basketball. And then he was followed by a couple of guys, Cedric Dempsey and a couple of guys that were good. But the NCAA, like this fiasco they got into with Penn State, something they have no concern or no business about.
Jonas Aaron, the New York Times, has kind of been hinting that there is a racial bias there, that they come down harder on black players than they do on white players.
Well, you know, who knows about that? That's difficult to really figure out. But I just think that there should be some restraints relative, and this goes to the high school associations, really curbing and controlling summer basketball far more than they do.
Well, when you recruited high school players, what things did you look for on and off the court?
Well, I wanted to see what kind of a student a kid was. I wanted to talk to a guidance counselor at the high school and say, okay, we've got Jimmy Jones here. He's a C-plus student. What should he be? Well, this kid really works hard. And maybe he could move up to a B-minus capacity. And I said, well, that's great. But now if I say, what is Billy Smith? And the guidance counselor says, well, Billy Smith is a C-minus student who should be an A student. I'm not really interested in recruiting that
Even though he's a bright kid.
That doesn't make any difference.
You resigned from Texas Tech in the middle of 2007-08 season. And was there a reason that
no,
you just got bored?
No, I just coached enough. At that moment, I just coached enough.
And are you enjoying being a commentator on ESPN?
Oh, yeah, it's easy. ESPN has been a really good company to work with. The people there I have thoroughly enjoyed, and it gives me something to do. And I do and always will enjoy the game, and it gives me a real opportunity to be involved with basketball.
Well, as I mentioned, you had 902 Division I college basketball victories, second most in NCAA history. What do you say to critics who don't agree with your approach to coaching?
Nothing. I could care less. I never need to have a conversation with my critics to understand what my responsibilities are. And so many times I thought that critics might not be as attuned to the situation as I might be.
Bob Knight will be giving a reading, and he'll also be signing books tonight at 6 o'clock at Bookends in Ridgewood, New Jersey. I suspect you enjoy getting out and meeting the folks these days.
Yeah, people are always nice, and they'll ask questions, and I'll try and answer the questions. And basically, I really enjoy being a part of basketball that way. And I really want to make sure I say this to you, because you brought this up when I first sat down about Billy Packer and I being here a couple of years ago, and I want to say to you, you were good then, and you're still good. You're like, for me, this is the third year, and you have were good as a freshman, and now you've been good as a junior.
Been doing it 28 years. The Power of Negative Thinking, Bob Knight's latest book, published by New Harvest. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you for having me. As always, I have enjoyed it.
On tomorrow's show, NYU's President John Sexton explains how baseball can be much more than a game. His class, Using Baseball to Illustrate Spirituality, has become one of the most popular courses on campus. Plus, we will talk to a man who trains Navy SEALs and how the demanding training prepares recruits for missions around the world. Also, Jamie Quatro talks about her collection of short stories called I Want to Show You More, and we'll take a look at what's happened to the New Orleans school system since Hurricane Katrina through the eyes of two students and a principal. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Eganzi, executive producer. Debbie Darcher was at the audio controls. And we had help today from Todd McGovern, Sarah Waltuck, and contributing producer Galen Druk. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.